Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, a podcast by guitar nerds. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Naomi McLeod.
Hello.
And JD Short.
Greetings, all.
Yes, indeed. And we are back. We're back for the 10th episode. This is the 10th episode. I just didn't write that in the document. Yes, we are back with the 10th episode, the final episode of series one of the Bass Guitar Nerds. Last episode for this year, for 2020, the worst year of all years, but good, good, because it was the year of the first series of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. And after that, we're going to be back with Gear of the Year, because we're going to do Gear of the Year Bass as part of the Guitar Nerds Gear of the Year series, which will be coming up, mid-December or whatever. So we've got four episodes of the Guitar Nerds and then one episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds. Because, you know, as with everything else, less things have been released this year. So we'll be talking about best bass guitars, best bass amps, and best bass effects pedals that have landed in 2020, which would be cool. So you can catch us again on that. But yes, as I say, this will be the last episode. So we're going to try and answer some of your questions, because you've all been getting involved. Really good, actually. Everyone's been really wonderfully vocal on our Facebook group. facebook.com/groups/guitar nerds forum. People have been getting very involved and are asking our hosts, Naomi, JD, and me, some really good questions. So we're going to try and get through some more of those and sort of finish the series on that. But first of all, Naomi, who's become like a bit of a Helix convert since last week, you got yourself one of the HX Stomps, and Line 6 have only gone and given another upgrade, Helix 3.0. They were very good at doing updates. It feels like the product that keeps on giving.
Yes, it does indeed. So this was all over my socials on whatever day it was a few days back. And I scrambled to my HX edit and got it loaded. And it has not disappointed. I'd like to say that I went in and, you know, really explored the firmware updates outside of the really cool effects that they've added and amps, but that's not what happened. I got really distracted by the cool amps and cabs and effects that have been added. So in the case of the HX Stomp, which is the only one I can speak for because it's the one I own, we have gone from 6 to 8 blocks. So that's the...
Oh, really? Wow.
That's... Yeah. So that's the most kind of fundamental or maybe most obvious addition. In 3.0, which is superb. Now, we don't get more DSP with that, obviously, so I think...
Right, so you've got to be careful.
Yeah, I don't think you're... You know, I don't necessarily think you're going to be able to go wild, let's say, with maybe pitch and time-based effects in the way that some might like to. But, yeah, for all intents and purposes, we've gone from 6 to 8, which is super awesome. Stoked about that. In addition to that, the new effects are pretty impressive, and I ran through some of them just before we hit record this evening.
It's very fuzz centric, the effects updates that they've gone for.
Yeah, the distortion updates include three fuzzes. So out of five distortion updates, there's three fuzzes there.
With three new fuzzes, there must be like 20 fuzzes now on the Helix.
I think your guess might be better than mine, but yeah, I feel like it's well over. It's well over kind of 10 or 12 anyway, which is plenty to be going on with.
Sure.
So the Horizon Drive was the one that everyone was speaking about, which is based on the Horizon Devices Precision Drive. Really, really into that. I was pretty impressed by how well the low end holds. I've heard the Precision Drive, but I haven't used it myself. So the Horizon was my first experience of playing it. Actually on the Stomp itself. They've also done a HM2 copy, which is the Swedish chainsaw patch.
Topical at the moment, as Bosch have just announced their
collaborative
effort to reintroduce that.
Yeah, which is awesome in its own right. But yeah, definitely good to have that there on the Stomp. I'm going to be trying some parallel processing on that to really get the gnarl from the Swedish chainsaw.
Oh, cool.
With some clean low end. And then the fuzzes, I just had a quick run through them. There's the Pocket Fuzz, which is based on the Jordan Boss Tone Fuzz. There's the Bighorn Fuzz, which I probably played with the most, based on the Ram's Head Big Muff Pie. Mm-hmm. Which is super tasty. And then the Ballistic Fuzz, based on the Euthemia ICBM Fuzz.
Oh, so, that's very cool.
Yeah, sounded awesome. So, yeah, I mean, really, the Horizon Drive, again, is the one that a lot of people are talking about. It's the one, personally, that I messed around with the most. Super impressed.
No new bass amps this time. It was quite limited on the amp updates, right?
Yes, it was. The new amps are... Yeah, they're Princeton. There's a Princeton amp, and then there's two VH4s.
Oh, a couple of diesel styles, right.
Yeah. And then two Princeton cab additions as well, one by 10 and one by 12. It's not a huge amount there. And then because I am a pitch shift addict, I checked out the poly pitch, the poly wham, the poly capo, or poly capo.
The poly capo sounds like a great product for bass players.
It is. And more than anything, the tracking, not that the tracking didn't impress me, before 3.0, but the tracking on the new patches is super awesome. In my kind of quick run through, I was really deliberately kind of messing around on the lower two strings, and they were holding. It was very, very impressive, I have to say.
That's very cool. Have you messed around with it much, the polycapo? Because kind of, the reason I ask, my question is it just like transposing? Is it a capo or is it a spider capo? As in, you know, could I transpose down my low E string to a B, but leave everything else as is?
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. But that's the question I'm going to ask as soon as we finish this evening.
Still a fantastic product otherwise.
Absolutely.
Just being able to not have to shift around it. It's just, you know, if I could have a digital detuner on my bass, like that would be very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
Like, I feel like the spider capo would have to happen, like you'd have to have separate outs almost, because elsewise, how would you know which string?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
I'm not thinking of this from a technology perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, of course, you could do that with the, if you're using the Helix with a Variax.
There we are.
Yeah.
If you're using it with a Variax, which of course they don't do a bass option anymore, you can get the Shuriken baritone. No bass option at the moment for that. So yeah, you're probably right. It is just going to be a general purpose capo, isn't it? Oh.
Yeah. Super cool for like momentary work, though, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, especially with that awesome tracking.
And it looks like a more complex looper as well. Shuffling looper.
Yeah, I haven't played with the looper yet. And I'll tell you I shouldn't say embarrassing secret, actually, because I really like it. I literally have just used the Ditto, like the simplest looper in the actual world for my looping time. and haven't bothered with really exploring much else loop-wise just yet. So
they're really good. I actually...
Yeah, have you used the looper on the Stomp then?
On the Helix, I
sorry,
had.
Yeah,
and it was fine. It looks like this one's just sort of extended range to it. The loop is very good on the Helix because they've kind of thought about the DL4 looper.
Yeah.
So you get the half time and the reverse function on there, which is very, very useful.
Mm.
I really like the Ditto though. Like just on a tangent on that, I still think it's the best little looper if you just want simple looping. At GAC we were doing these things where these challenges for a few weeks where I had to go and get a load of effects pedals and had to recreate a movie theme using like a loop, one guitar, a looper and a load of effects. And I used to get one of the other fellas would play the parts and then I would switch them all in. I always did it with a Ditto just because when you're actually hand controlling pedals like that, mm-hmm. rather than with your feet, just that the sort of soft touch Ditto button is so much better than a big block on the Boss. I find the Boss one, whilst that is incredibly hard wearing, difficult to get the precision that you need for looping. And
yeah, definitely. And you find yourself if you're at ground level, which I mean, your use for it there sounds awesome and creative. But I mean, quite a lot of times at gigs, if you're like finishing a set or something, maybe you're using your hand on your looper.
Yeah.
And yeah, you don't want to be using like the base of your hand and having to put half the weight of your torso into to start and end a loop. Yeah, so definitely a plus one for TC on the design there.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're reminding me actually the few times I borrowed an M9 over the years, I loved the looper on them, which I'm pretty sure was the same.
The DL4. Yeah.
It was the same DL4 design, exactly, yeah.
It was so good. The only looper I've ever used that I've thought was more fun was on the semi-successful, what do they call it? They just call it pedal. You know, 11 Rack had the Headrush pedal board.
Yeah.
I think they still do it. It's just almost been kind of superseded by everything else.
Yeah.
I think that when it came out, it was just unlucky enough to come out. It was an affordable version of the Helix, and they brought it out just as Line 6 released the Helix LT.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just like, they just couldn't. It felt like they couldn't keep up.
Yeah.
But I loved the product. It was really cool. It had like a touch screen. It weighed a ton, but that wasn't the end of the world. It was just, I think they struggled to get new stuff on board whilst Helix were just updating their catalog all the time.
Yeah.
11 Rack really weren't. But their looper was incredible because it had all the features of the DL4. Plus you had an infinite time doubler as well as time subtractor.
Oh,
so
nice.
You could just hit a pedal over and over again and that your loop would keep on speeding up until it's just ridiculous noise. And from a sort of like a making weird sounds perspective, I was like, this is a fantastic feature that I've never seen on any other pedal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's good to have kind of slightly more outside the box design on something as what's the word, like fundamental as a looper in terms of effect, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Now, but yeah, the HX Stomp 3.0 Helix 3.0. Dear listener, if you're a Helix user on bass, absolutely worth upgrading by the sounds of it. Now, last week we were talking about upgrades, and you guys got me thinking about upgrades. So I went out and I bought a bridge. I realized, you know, as I'd said, I'd never done a bridge update. So I got a new bridge. I went for the Omega bridges. Have you heard of those?
Yes, I have.
I went for it because it wasn't very expensive, you know, and it was my first foray into bridge changing. But they're like are they like an all parts brand?
Yeah, Omega? I think so, because I think that's, I just have to double check though. I haven't seen one for a bit. So they're the ones, which one did you get? It seems like there's a few different styles.
Oh yeah, like that was it. I was like, I don't. There are so many, but I think it was just like variants. If you wanted the little notched tops, but I was like, why would you want that? That's surely what you're getting away from on vintage bridges. But they had that, or just the normal flat bit of metal, and they had them different ones if they were through strung.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I just went for the regular one as I was planning to put it on my 60s reissue jazz bass. But really affordable, really good. They're obviously just a copy of the Badass.
Yeah.
Just a big, chunky chrome bridge. I was looking for something in nickel, you know, rather than chrome, because it just ages more nicely. But I couldn't find anything on that. So, yeah, so I went for the bridge update. It turned up today, and I did it immediately. It was super easy, because it's just a 5-screw switch over. No issues with that at all.
No big job.
No, exactly, which was fantastic. So thank you very much, JD, for the, you know, the encouraging me to do that. I think this was a good decision.
You're welcome. How do you find it, like, tonally?
Everything feels, and this could be perceived as well, but everything feels, like, tighter around the bridge. Yeah. If I'm finger picking above the bridge pickup on the jazz bass, it feels a bit more like it's 60s pickup placing, but you know, the 70s pickup placing is closer to the bridge, and it's the strings are much obviously tighter there. It feels a bit more like that. But yeah, like for it, it feels less clangy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean that in a positive way, even though I'd normally use clangy as a positive description of a bass sound. Everything feels more secure and more rooted in, and I think, you know, it was definitely a good decision. Considering, I'm still on the fence of like how much this is worth it if you've got like a modern jazz bass or P bass with a modern bridge on it. But if you've got a vintage reissue, as I do with these tiny little flimsy bridges, it really is actually worth it. It makes everything much more robust and, you know, tonally a bit more consistent. But yeah, that was super cool. And I got my I was messaging you guys about this because I wasn't sure what to get. I was like, do I get the DiMarzio jazz pickups because they're affordable? Do I get the Bartolini's, which I struggled to find in stock anywhere, a set of Bartolini jazz pickups? They have some wonderful options. They have them where every string has like the two pole pieces are angled in the same way that a precision pickup is, which
super
I thought
cool.
Which was really cool. Lovely, like, attention to detail there. And I really did want those, but they were a chunk of money. They were more expensive than anything else because they're, you know, they're £200 and up sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going for just a set of EMG jazz bass pickups. Which I know is they're active and all, but I didn't know this. They're solderless.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
they have a whole series, of the solderless ones. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a set. They cost no more money. They're pretty decently priced, like £120 for a set of the, you know, the solderless two jazz bass pickups, and it's like comes with an instruction manual. You can just pop them in there yourself, no problems. Which I thought was absolutely fantastic. I was amazed at how quickly I could turn my 60s jazz bass into, you know, a sort of 80s Pink Floyd machine.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to buy some of those. I
think that's one of my favorite pickup designs to come out, like in the last, I don't know, however many years they've been kind of doing that, where it's just, because it's not hard, but like swapping pickups has always been such a barrier for a lot of people who, one, either don't want to solder or solder, as we say in the States, if you want to, you know, and or just don't want to have the kit to do it. Because like there's, you know, there's plenty of times where I often have, I don't know, 3 or 4 different sets of pickups lying around, and it would be like easy enough for me to be like, you know, I think it would be great if I could drop in my Nordstrands, or I drop in some DiMarzios or something into a jazz bass just to spice it up a bit or just give it some sort of change. But it's like, oh, I don't want to do this, or I don't want to keep changing my pickups, because I, at some stage, you start losing length in the lead wires, you know, and then at that point, it's like, you can only do it so many times before it's done, or you splice or something. But it's like, like electromechanically, it doesn't. You don't really, like, a solderless connection is fine. Like it's just a wire connected to a magnet. Like it's not, you know, like we're not transmitting you know, the internet under the Pacific Ocean, you know, like it's that's all it needs to go through. And it's like, yeah, it's such a quick thing to be able to just think ever so slightly smartly about it and be like, wouldn't it be great if the thing we sell, like pickups, could easily be swapped and changed, as opposed to like it being an ordeal or needing to take it into a shop to have it done?
You're 100%
totally right. Yeah, I can only imagine how much bigger a market that opens it up to immediately, which
absolutely
is super cool.
Like even for me, who's I'm okay at soldering. If you know,
you're very good.
Thanks. Well, I do it often, but I don't enjoy it. Like it is a relatively stressful thing to do, sort of thing.
I love soldering. I swear to God, I love soldering.
I love the smell of my own burnt flesh at least once during
exactly
it.
Yeah. JD. Joe, I don't know what's wrong with you. I'll be honest.
Yes. Maybe I am bad at it in that case, because I find it a very stressful thing. And so coming across this product, I was like, oh, so, and don't get me wrong, if you were to ask me to pick what my favorite pickup was, I would have said the Bartolini. Now, I've loved every set of Bartolinis I've ever played. I think they look fantastic as well. I love that they put their name across the sort of the blank covering of the pickup. And I loved the idea behind the angled pole pieces. But even that wasn't quite enough for me to then see the EMGs and be like, oh, you mean I can just pop these in? No, I'm going to do that then. You know, it was just, that was essentially what sold it. And that they do it for a relatively affordable price, like £120 for a pair of jazz pickups, I think. Isn't bad at all. I mean, I know, you can obviously pick up, you know, Fender replacement pickups for £60 or Seymour Duncan's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was, rather good. I'm pretty chuffed about this, but we'll see how it goes. I realized after I swapped them in, that I don't have a 9-volt battery here.
Oh man.
So I need to go out and get a 9-volt battery. I'll do that tomorrow.
Do you have 6 double A's?
I'll see what I can dig up. Anyway, we did say we'd answer a bunch of questions, so maybe we'll move on to that. Actually, just quickly before we do, can we talk about these Illuminati necks?
Illuminati.
Illuminati.
I mean, this is cool. Illuminati. This is not the first company to be offering, obviously, replacement aluminium or aluminum necks for bass. This is something that all companies that deal in aluminium instruments tend to offer.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the things that most companies offer tend to be like custom-made things, you know. Whereas... These are the Andromeda aluminium or aluminum bass necks from Illuminati Guitar Co. And it looks like they're offering 34-inch scale, available in purple or just the plain aluminium.
I mean,
it's pretty cool.
You can't just say purple. Like, it is a very vibrant, rich purple.
It's purple in all caps. It is italicized
purple.
In
like,
bold.
Yeah. Prince would be like, that may be too purple. You know, like
Prince would nearly crack a smile at how purple this neck is.
Yeah. It is very, I love it. Just to be clear, but it is very, very purple.
I think these look fantastic. Really cool. I love that the headstock's like cut out on the back as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which, listener, I don't know if that translates as a description at all, but it's like a hollow back of the headstock, which is very cool. Obviously, a lot of companies that do, you know, sort of metalwork guitar necks do the stamped logo on the headstock where it goes the whole way through, and they've followed suit here with the A for Illuminati going through the entire headstock. These are cool.
Yeah, I really dig them. I dig that they're 2x2. For the 4 strings, it looks like, you know, so that it's like,
mm-hmm.
I think they're really cool. I think it's such a cool thing to be able to like swap like an aluminium neck, just because there's so many times I've really wanted one, and you know, I've had bodies of basses that I also really liked, and to be able to get basically like an aluminum necked bass, you end up looking at like some of the old Kramers, you look at some of the old like vintage ones to be able to get something for, you know, $1,000 US or sub $1,000 US. That's basically your only real options. And so like being able to like take something today, be able to order something and be like, oh, this is what I get. But yeah, like they seem excellent. And being able to like, I'm imagining putting this on like a vintage Fender body, like a 78 P bass with an aluminium, especially a bright purple aluminium neck would be, one, just to see who it wound up would be worth it.
Yeah.
Right. But
yeah.
Like tonally, I would really like to play these. I think I'm really intrigued by them and see like how Travis Beanie they get, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. 100%. Well, $1,000 on the street is what the price is. And I was wrong. I'm obviously just reading the press release and saying there's purple and silver. There are 11 colors to choose from.
I was just gonna say I'm on the side here checking them out, all as vibrant as the beautiful purple that we've just seen, and of course my favorite, including a jet black. So you can only imagine how smart that would look on, like you're saying, JD, on some like a super traditional vintage body, like a 78p or something. I would love to see that and hear it and play it.
This is very exciting. I think I'm gonna have to buy one.
What color are you gonna go for if you do?
It would be black. It would have to be the black. Carbon fiber fretboard as well, which
so good.
Which
I'm
awesome.
Very excited about.
No endangered woods in sight.
Yeah. Oh, and you can pay for it monthly.
Yeah, monthly is the thing that. Yeah, so it's basically like you're looking at, what, 100 US or so like that to do. Like, the one, that's just such a smart way to do it. Because also, I don't know, the brushed aluminium, like that silver, the one that's not like super shiny chrome.
Is Voyager really, Silver, they call it. Yeah.
Yeah, the names are great. Pulsar Purple. That's
there's Pleiadian pink,
Pleiadian.
All the vowels are there. Yeah, so it's $150 extra for some of the weirder colors.
Oh, gold. Look at that. Oh.
Corona gold. Yeah. That is.
That's not this year. We'll get to that.
But yeah, this is a super cool product.
Oh, the red.
What's interesting to me, and you guys tell me, is there something fundamental I'm missing here? But the fact that there's just one scale length for now is interesting, because
only 34.
I would love to see a shorter scale. Is there something in the manufacture of aluminium necks that would make that not a good idea? Or
I think it's just the machining.
It's just where we're at for now.
You think that I imagine the bulk of the type of players who would be looking for carbon fiber fretboards and aluminium necks are going to be playing in particular genres that probably have quite detuned basses.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, see, like for me, like, well, I obviously don't necessarily do that, but like for me, like it really feels much more like Jesus Lizardy, like that sort of piercing tone that isn't necessarily drop tuned or is dropped like a half step, you know, like a E flat tuning sort of thing. But like, I sort of see it as like being like tight and grindy more so than be interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
These are dope.
I think I am gonna get one of these. All right, I'm gonna do this. Okay. Anyway, let's. we should take some questions from the group, because as I said, there were some very good ones. Let's start it off. Graham Sheridan has said, "What's the best cheap amp you've used, even if it was just to test?" As an example, he used a Behringer Ultra Bass BXD 3000H. He thought that was rather good. JD, do you want to start us off?
I'm trying to think of like the cheap amps that I've used in. Like, so most of it would be like amps that I think we've talked about is like cheap but value. So like that, if I really think about like bang for buck wise, for me it would still be probably one of the Harkey, like the 3500, like that head. I know that's not necessarily like super cheap, but like that's kind of what first drew me in, was just, you know, like his, instead of like multi-thousand, you know, dollar pound head. Also, just quick shout, like I do have a quite cheap amp that I've just got this week. I've been playing recently. It's a 1983 Marshall keyboard 12 amp. They got mostly for keyboards, but is also, as you imagine, pretty great for a bedroom.
Oh, cool.
So it's just quite old now. Marshall, like solid state Marshall amp, like 12 watts, just sounds fine. I mean, sounds like a more keyboardy guitar amp, so it's not like, it's a little sort of hollow sounding in the mids compared to like a big full bass rig, but like totally works. Actually sounds quite good with my upright, and which I sort of like, kind of that cutting dryness in the mids. But yeah, like got it for, you know, like super cheap. Small tiny little amp, but I think there's so many good small amps out there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it depends how affordable, you know, we need to be. But yeah, small rigs have come on such a long way in the last decade for bass players. About you, Naomi?
I feel like I've talked about both of these before, but I mean, my favorite, both in terms of portable-ish combo and sound and budget at the time, was a version, one of the first versions of Ampeg BA-115. Superb amp. And it was like in a store that I was working in and stayed there mysteriously. You know, it was just one of those amps that was like, how has someone not bought this and given it a really loving home yet? And I think it may have even been borrowed by a band or two to record with at the time. And they came back raving about it. So, it was just superb. And I mean, I wouldn't expect the world from a 1x15 specifically. But just kind of across styles kind of gave me everything I need the few times I did try it, so I was super super impressed by it. And they do pop up kind of cheapish secondhand.
They were definitely a cornerstone of like affordable amplification for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the other one, which again I think I might have mentioned before, which is a super unlikely contender, but I'm mentioning it just because it was so cheap, was, it was one of those Marshall MB series. It was the 4410. Their 4x10 combo was just in back lines across Ireland for quite a while. And I would turn up to gigs and people would be like, oh, I'm sorry, it's one of those. It's not much. It's a Marshall combo. And I'd see it and light up because I knew how hard I could drive it with the head that I was sneaking into it with a trusty speak on to female speaker jack, so I could basically rewire the, because you know the way a lot of those combos have the tail cable coming out from the cab into the head of the combo. So I was kind of reverse engineering that, so putting my own head into that cab.
Ah, smart.
Yes.
Very smart. Yeah, those Marshall combos always, they looked like props. They looked like they felt like pretend amplifiers. They were so,
yes, they did.
Everything on them was so incredibly flimsy. Like if the Marshall logo had been made out of thinner, lighter weight plastic, it would have disintegrated.
It would have just jumped off the amp. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they were
done here.
They were funny. They were good. I'm going to go for an amp from the same era, actually. That was a little bit smaller, but the it was affordable only because it was so small. But the Gensbenz Shuttle 3.0. The Shuttle range. Oh, it was so good. Everything in that Shuttle range was fantastic. But the 3.0 was sold as a combo, but the head was removable, like a bit like a drop head on an Ampeg or something. It came in its own little kind of one U thing on the top of the single 10-inch speaker that it came with. But my goodness, like I remember when we had those at GAC, and the whole thing with those Gensbenzes, you'd be like, you could put a 5 or a 6 string bass through it, and it was also fine, you know, for a 110. Yeah. It was a 300-watt combo. I mean, 300-watt at 4 ohms, I think it's obviously putting out about 175 into the actual 110, but super loud enough to gig, really versatile tone shaping, built like tanks. Those, all of that Gensbenz Shuttle series, because I think there was like a Shuttle 12 and a Shuttle like 9.2 as well, a few other bits and bobs. Really good range of amplifiers. It was, you know, a shame to see them disappear.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
But I think that they're back as Gensler now, aren't they?
Yeah.
Are they? Yeah, okay.
Because I think Fender bought Gensbenz, and I don't know if they've really done anything with them, and now Gensler are back again. But
I think, yeah, I think they bought, this is my, you know, lore and working assumption is that they bought Gensbenz, but it was before they really started pushing their own line of amps again. Like
yeah,
bass amps again, and same with like when, because you know when they had they bought SWR, and then that kind of just went away. It was like, oh, we're you know, it's like, oh, we'll buy an amp range to then sell it, and it's like, or we could just, what turns out people want Fender style amps, not SWR from Fender kind of thing.
Exactly.
Also, SWR is a good shout. Like cabinets were always great. Like a lot of their Working Man's 15, I think, was also a really good small cheap amp that I had for a really long time that I liked a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did they do a 4x10 in that series as well?
Probably.
It was Working something.
4x10. Probably, yeah, because they did those Workman's. That was basically their like sort of home entry range, you know, sort of
Working
thing.
Man.
But yeah, those are some good combos that I miss, that you used to be able to pick up, or you'd find places or something, you know, like back in the day when you could find something at like a pawn shop where no one knew what it was, and you're like, I'll take this, please, thank you, you know.
Nice. Yeah it was the Working Man's 4x10T that I played a few times. Big fan.
I mean, the idea of 4x10 combos is just, it just speaks to like, we didn't know what we were doing.
No,
right?
Well, yeah. Let's not forget that the Ashdown did the Mark King head as an 8x10 combo.
Oh, good.
Do you remember that?
I do now.
Very good.
I love that there'd be something that size that there's no way you can share with anyone at a gig. great yeah, that was a brilliant product. I mean, I do think if we, you know, when it comes to affordable products, and since, you know, starting to work for Ashdown, I've kind of got what the other guitar nerds have, where they're sort of a little bit conscious about talking about the brands that they work for, even though I obviously played Ashdown for years and years before and have always been a big fan, so I sort of steer away from talking about them. But I I think I, you know, had I not felt like that when we started this question, I would have immediately gone for the old Ashdown like Mag series, the Mag 300s.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because they were on every single backline, and they obviously they did them in umpteen different combo formats, and there was like a 180 or a 240, maybe something like that, that had an especially blue face, and it was like you'd just see it at every small venue. It was the carpet covered combo that they'd pull out of the back, and it was just, you know, it wasn't amazing, but then none of the amplifiers that we're talking about right now are. It was just consistent, and you knew how to get a tone out of it. And as far as affordable amps go, they had a built-in compressor, a built-in valve driver, and you know, the subharmonic as well. So it was a bit of a Swiss sub. Army knife. Yeah, subharmonic.
Yeah. Does everyone remember their first time turning that up and being like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
I am Goliath. I own this tiny stage in this scout den.
I missed the times before... before controls were as uniformed as they are now on bass amps. Like we spoke about, and the other amp, obviously, even though we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, should be talked about, the Hartke HA series.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. the fact that you just have, you tone shape by the two volumes that they have, like one solid state, one valve. And that's, you know, obviously it does have a band EQ on there as well. But I love that that was how you kind of got your tone, by blending up these two different preamps. It's just such a weird idea, and again, built-in compressor. On the HA series.
I mean, it feels like for so many, like the small combos, like it's just a smart idea to put in like built-in limiters, and stuff. So it's like you can't drive, because it's, you know, so many of them, like everyone just gets, they treat the EQ like volume knobs. Like, I mean, how many times have you gone into like a rehearsal space or seen someone with an amp where it's like all the EQs dimed, and you're just like, what? But why? That's not how EQ works. It's just adding and boosting everything. And it's like, put my tones all distorted. And it's like, well, right, you know. But yeah, so it's just like having the built-in limiter so you don't end up like hurting anything and blowing up the amp is such a good idea. That compressor works so well, but yeah, like it's interesting that you see built-in compressors on almost all bass amps now. Like, really,
I guess a lot of them. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I guess quite a few will have a sort of a built-in limiter of some form. And yeah, you're absolutely right, it is a good idea. I guess everyone tries to put on something on a bass amp. I don't know if they do so much on guitar amps. I think on guitar amps people just try and make their tone distinctly recognizable, or a perfect emulation of something classic. Yeah. Whereas on bass amps, everyone's trying to put on a control that you'll find that you need, that you can't get from anywhere else. Like Mark Bass with their vintage loudspeaker emulator. And then I don't know what that's the VLE. I don't know what the VPF stands for, but that's their mid scoop control.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys familiar with Blackstar's Unity series?
Is that the affordable one with just the star on the front?
Yes, it is. And yeah,
I'm not familiar with them really at all.
Yeah, just they were the first bass amps that I saw with onboard effects, and they sound great. Like on all configurations of the series, they have overdrive, distortion, and fuzz, and chorus and sub octave on
good.
Yeah, as standard. It's, well, I bring it up only because it was my first time seeing it on bass amps.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Laney did their, I'm not going to be able to remember the name of their series of bass amps. It's still their current line of bass amps, and they were really, really good. Nexus, there we go. I think that's right. It might not be, I think it is. And they did their on their range of bass heads, it had chorus, and then there was one other effect, and I think it was reverb. Like, it was something what is this doing?
Yeah.
I'm not 100% that it was reverb, but the effects that were on there, and there was an octaver on there as well, but it was just like,
nice.
What is this? This is just an 80s machine, but it came out like 5 years ago. Very
super
cool.
Yeah,
very cool. Anyway, we should answer another question. So Robin Smith has said, I'm a guitarist, but I want to lay down some bass tracks at home through my Helix. Oh, this is a good one for you, Naomi. What's a good, cheap, guitarist-friendly bass for never playing through an amp, but only straight into Ableton via the Helix? And I guess this actually leads into some other questions we said we'd deal with kind of all at once. Because we've also had Matthew Quinn has said, if you're a guitar player who's moving to bass, where to start? And we've got one other, haven't we? I think.
Yes.
It was
from Eric Scott. Yeah, Bass Nerds, what would you suggest for a guitarist looking to get into bass for home recording and just expanding his skill set?
So kind of all the same sort of question. We'll talk about the Helix wise thing, but then let's talk about, you know, I guess affordable basses with an eye on guitarists moving towards it rather than a bass player taking it up for the first time.
Yeah. I don't know, do you guys want to like have a running bet for how long we get into each episode before I bring up short scale basses or Squire Broncos?
Yeah. It's the inevitable, isn't it? If we're talking about, I mean, that's kind of what I was getting at, wasn't I, when I was saying, if we're thinking about a guitarist who's moving to bass, and especially if in the case of like Robin Smith's thing, you know, he's saying he's not going to be using it live or even through an amp, but he's going to be using it at home, even from a kind of just convenience, space, everything else perspective. And, you know, on top of the ease of moving, you know, only up from... Yeah, he'll be moving up from 25, 26 inch scale only up to 30 rather than all the way up to 34.
Absolutely.
There are obvious advantages to sticking with short scale.
Yeah. And I feel also, you know, it's okay to kind of stick with ubiquity to a degree with stuff like this. So, you know, maybe it's not that different to if any of the three of us were looking for a guitar to have, you know, I feel like it would be somewhat likely that a general recommendation would be something like a Baja Tele, just because it's tried and tested.
Well, on this show.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? It's like, you know, something that's fairly widely regarded in its field, I suppose, as a bit of a go-to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, for that reason, like the very obvious sort of answer is sort of the Mustang, or in the super budget range, something like the Bronco.
I mean, I agree. And also just partially because I guess what you're going to want is a really well-trodden bass tone as well.
Yeah. There's nothing too wild about the tone in either of those basses.
No, exactly.
You know, yes, it's a little left of the very classic kind of P or J tones, let's say. It is that little bit subbier and kind of different in its characteristics. But if nothing else, I mean, it's a very bassy tone, you know. So if you're wanting to completely get away from sort of guitar sonically, it will do that for you, obviously.
I do think the Bronco needs some upgrades, though, like off the bat, kind of to make it good. Whereas aiming maybe at the classic vibe Mustang bass.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Cool colours in that as well. White with a torque guard, or I can't remember if it's a blue or a green. Is it Daphne Blue or Sonic Blue? Maybe.
Oh, in the classic vibe, yeah, absolutely.
Or is it green? No, it is a green, yeah, in the classic vibe. Surf green with a perloid guard. So you're choosing between those two, Olympic white or surf green, which is pretty cool. That's a pretty cool choice to be able to make.
Yeah, for sure. And then obviously into the player series are kind of the next price bracket. You have some gorgeous kind of colour options there as well.
Plus you get a PJ pickup. PJ pickup configuration in the player series. And then all of a sudden, you've got a jazz bass and a P bass.
Yeah, which is especially for home recording or stuff. Because you really would get a wide range of traditional sounds out of either of those or blending those. And I think, you know, like if you're not super into bass yet, but you want something versatile, like, yeah, the PJ option sounds great. You know, like gives you a ton of versatility without like Yeah, it all feels like bang for buck that you're trying to get, right? Like you're trying to, like you're not wanting to go, you know, full bore on anything. It's just sort of like, let's just make sure I have something really versatile, something I can use. But yeah, so I mean, these are all great shouts so far.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I do think we should probably mention something
from Yamaha.
By all means, something from Yamaha, but something in the 34 inch, something in the 34 inch range as well that we would all consider sort of a go to.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, as bass 101 for a guitarist,
we are also kind of presuming here that like the versatility, and this is a perfectly reasonable presumption for us to have made, but that versatility and kind of standard tone is the aim of this. And I think in that case, I do think that the Player Mustang is probably the best thing from a short scale perspective.
Yes, I would agree with that.
But for like, if you're thinking affordable and you want a bass and maybe you want short scale and you're not too fussed about the tone, and you might think, well, I do like that, but I would like something that looks super cool around the home. The Epiphone Viola bass, the Hofner Ignition violin bass, which I saw someone had purchased recently on the group, both incredibly affordable and they look so good. The Epiphone one I do think trumps the Hofner on build quality for the price, and you get a center block on the Epiphone, so you can actually drive it unlike the Hofner.
Yeah, the only downside I see to the Hofner is that like, they do a thing, it feels like, you know, like there's like they don't feel super versatile to me, you know, but no, I agree with you, like it's, you know, it's like they do that vibe where, you know, like you, whereas like if we're looking at a Mustang or like a jazz bass or a Yamaha BB series bass, something like that, like it could do any style of music and feel natural and sit well. Whereas like the Hofner made probably could, but like you'd have to play a special kind of metal for it to really work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I got a violin bass and brought it to a polymath practice once.
Did you?
Yeah. I probably played it for half an hour before.
Did your saxophonist like blow a gasket?
I got about half an hour in before I was asked to change back onto something else.
Oh God!
It really was not. It's not the right instrument.
Were you in like drop C?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know the bridge is just like fret wire on a Hofner violin bass, so it really wasn't handling the drop C incredibly well.
It wasn't. Yeah, sounds like it was a bass welfare call that was made in that case. Can I give a really, really brief shout to another one in the super budget range, which I'm not sure if we've touched on, but does actually come in short scale and short and long scale, all for under the 200 mark. Are you guys familiar with the Ibanez TMB series at all?
I am.
Yeah, that's another PJ contender that I've only laid my hands on a few times.
This is the Talman.
The Talmans. Yeah. They're not going to set the world on fire, obviously, with the parts included at that price point, but in terms of a bass to have at hand in a room for a little bit of recording, I absolutely would be a fan of their tone,
especially if you want something unique.
Yeah,
exactly. They are that little bit different, and they look really cool as well.
They have the like that offset style. Like I love the headstocks on those. I think I looked at getting one. I think because they have a black one with a tort guard.
It looks incredible.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like what, like 150? It's less. It's they're cheap as they're, you know, they're 200 quid. You know, like you can get the that's an excellent shout.
Yeah, one on my hen's teeth search list currently is, I think it was a 2018 model, but they did an unbelievable turquoise sparkle with neck inlays, matching headstock. And I mean, its retail price was something like still under 200.
These are so affordable.
Yeah, they're so cool. And like this limited, I mean, it was like, you know, sort of FSR equivalent, it was limited to 2018. I think they did like one run or something. Right. And the only one I've seen since. Like, I have searches set up and everything, but the only one I've seen since was going for like £600.
Amazing.
Of course. So
they have a I will haven't get seen one. This. They have a black on black short scale.
Yeah. It looks so good. They've got some great ones. I'm actually quite into the five string. Have you seen this?
Yeah, they do a 5 as well.
I mean, okay, we're so far away from guitarists getting basses because absolutely guitarists don't buy a 5-string. It'll confuse you.
you'll have a weird time. Yeah, I mean, they do a walnut finish as well, which is super pretty. Anyway, yeah, sorry not to go off on a big tangent, but I just thought the Talman TMB was more than deserving of a shout because, again, they are so cheap. They look cool. We've actually got that PJ configuration that we were just talking about. And yeah, super comfortable players and they sound good.
They have an ivory color with a black guard. If they had a torque guard... It would be in my cart at the moment.
Yeah, the ivory is sweet. It's very kind of Olympic white.
It's an aged ivory. It's an ivory from a smoking elephant who's well aged.
I see. Yes. Yeah. The black with a torque guard for it's 229 for the black with the torque guard. It is more money. But the short scale one.
I guess one for 1.5 somewhere. 1.5, 1.51.
These are so good.
I think this may actually be because it ticks so many boxes in that it looks slightly unique. It looks very classic. Mm-hmm. It's it's easy. They're easy to play. They're great. We all highly recommend. And they're so cheap that if you're wanting to do like proper bass lines and properly sort of just because you play differently on a bass than you would a guitar anyway, but to be able to like record and not just play your guitar with an octave or something and play like fairly boring bass lines as you would just naturally do that way, I think it's a really good shout, like looking at these Ibanez TMBs.
I completely agree. They're very good. Well, there you go. I think that answers all three of those questions, which leaves us only one to try. One, well, there are a few, there, with only one more that I think we're going to try to answer, which is should we do what do you guys think? JJ's question as our last question, or we actually kind of answered Mike Coe's question, who asked why don't more people play Hofner violin basses.
Oh, well, there you
so
go.
So there you go, bonus question answered. So Jeffrey JJ says, as a guitarist who has played bass a few times and found it really difficult, what are some of the most common mistakes guitarists make when playing the bass and how can they be avoided?
Yeah, I think this question has been asked potentially more than once, so sorry to anyone who we didn't get to before, but I think it's a really good question as well, because I think all of us are familiar, it goes both ways, bassists playing a bit of guitar and guitarists playing a bit of bass. And obviously with the fretboard being fundamentally the same structure, it's easy to assume things of the other instrument, isn't it?
Yeah absolutely. I think on the Guitar Nerds Facebook group, this came up actually in a discussion where someone who had recently taken up bass from guitar was saying how surprised they were at how different it was, just tonally, like how much more, I remember the thing he said that he noticed the most was how much more important each individual note's playing is, almost how much difference there is between finger style and playing with a plectrum, whereas guitar it's relatively negligible. Mm-hmm. It's a massive choice and a huge tonal choice on a bass, as is where you're playing on the instrument, whereas on a guitar it's that again is virtually completely non-existent. Where your right hand is positioned isn't making a lot of tonal difference at all. On the bass it's everything, it's the sound of a jazz bass versus the sound of a Hofner violin bass, whether you're playing at the bridge or the neck.
Yeah,
and absolutely. And then just and I think it was like how much how much harder it is to be consistent across the strings, I think was something that was mentioned as well, which is of course why, you know, bass players love compression so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's of course, absolutely, there's dexterity required in both instruments, but obviously physically you're working with a larger instrument with bass, aren't you? So your technique in both hands is going to be different. It's not that it's harder or easier, but there are bigger reaches both horizontally and vertically, for left and right hand. And yeah, obviously with that comes nuances in technique. I would definitely recommend to anyone to check out some educators. You know, like, we're living in such a golden age now where there's unbelievable advice on YouTube. Like, I remember looking up Marlo DK years ago. I don't know if either of you guys are familiar. Then getting into Scott Devine. Then I ended up taking some lessons with Evan Marion, who is bringing out a book soon as well. Yeah, sort of just as little or as much as you want to delve into that, it's a really awesome thing to just sort of touch base with some educator, whether it's watching one YouTube video or going as deep as taking one or two lessons or paying to watch a masterclass or something like that. Because, identifying someone who plays music that you love, and then if you're lucky enough that they are also an educator, I think it's a brilliant way to break down barriers of kind of getting to know the fundamentals of the instrument, for sure.
Yeah, I completely agree. I you know, a second upvote for Scott Devine from Scott's Bass Lessons, who I think we mentioned before on this, but they're just such wonderful, great lessons, and he does a good range of stuff from like the ground up. So he can really teach you to get started, as well as how to. I have to say, I left his lessons at one point because his stuff is very formulaic, and it's based around kind of a professional bass player, which is what he's aiming at. Mm-hmm. But he's like, you know, he's talking about sight reading and where to position your neck and your the line of your eyes so that you can keep an eye on what you're doing whilst reading music. Like, there's stuff like that, and it becomes too formulaic at some point. Like, he really, really pushes away from players who anchor their thumb, which is essentially my whole playing style. My thumb stays permanently in that position, and I use my thumb for my low string for the bulk of my stuff. And I was kind of like, I don't really want to move away from that, because I like having the extra finger on the fretboard for making some chord shapes.
But
you don't obviously have to take on everything that you get taught. I think for basic fundamentals, he's brilliant, and he's taught me loads of stuff.
Yeah, he is, absolutely. And like, that sort of segs into my next point, because I was nervous to make this point. I mean, the first I suppose input that popped into my head when I read the question was the thing that some people can slip into if they're moving from guitar to bass is the idea of playing the bass like a guitar, being super melodic. Like, I don't want to say overplaying, but I suppose technically it is a bit of a habit that one can slip into if you're going from a very melodic instrument to something that objectively carries a different role. Because obviously, everyone has different tastes. Like, the three of us have different tastes, and that makes for great conversation. Do you know what I mean? But I can't not make the point about less is more when playing the bass, even just to start out, like, fundamentally. And while we're talking about educators as well, I think there's a superb bit of video from Victor Wooten's, is it called The Groove Workshop? Does that ring any bells to you guys? There was like a Vic Wooten DVD that I may or may not have watched on the internet, and not the DVD. There's a bit in it which I hope is somewhere super accessible to people, called the Rhythm Yardstick, where he runs through basically like clapping exercises and one note exercises at various points in a bar of four. And it really, really stuck with me, just in terms of how much you can change a groove by just playing one note of bass in a bar and then shifting around where you're playing that one note and how that can change the feel.
Oh, that sounds great. I love the idea.
Oh,
that.
It's awesome. Yeah, if I can find it, I'll definitely...
Oh, please do. Share it on the group.
Yeah, I'll link it in the group. Because, it really kind of helped me to turn a corner in terms of how I view the bass's role.
Right.
Because I would never say, bass is the be-all, end-all rhythm instrument. Like, I grew up in love with Cliff Burton, do you know what I mean, and his lines. So it's like it's definitely not just a rhythm instrument to me, but so I'm rambling, but yeah. what I mean is I wouldn't call playing lead a common mistake.
No.
Fundamentally, but it's something to be very mindful of if you're first getting into playing bass, for sure.
Yeah, completely agree.
And I would, just sort of my take was all going to be around, like, just primarily around note length and just sort of approaching bass as bass. And if you're to really get into the mindset is to sort of, again, if you're watching YouTube or whatever, is to sort of look at the bass players that other bass players like and sort of try to figure out why. But it is in kind of coming back to the idea around that you're making, Naomi, around the just different techniques that you would use. Like, if you're thinking about playing rhythm guitar, like, a lot of the shapes and stuff you'll be playing is, you know, certainly if you think about acoustic guitar or whatever, where you're playing a chord shape and then your picking hand is mostly somewhat randomly playing, you know, like, notes and letting them kind of just, you know, like, kind of go and sort of like exist on top of something. But like, when you're playing bass, you're playing the thing that the other stuff exists on top of a lot of times, and you have like a much richer harmonic role to play in that as well. But it's also it's just the note length and being able to change a groove and to sort of like play intentionally. So you it's like when you see the sloppiness and it's just different. It's just you think differently. So you see notes like kind of like a lot of times I'll see like when guitar players play bass, it's either playing it like a guitar, but it a lot of it for me is the letting the notes last too long, you know? And so like with bass, it's all about the length and playing. So sort of like also bring in that clapping exercise of like playing with like how long each note is and being like really specific with, you know, whether or not you're playing a quarter or an eighth or something and sort of pushing that a bit and sort of seeing like, oh, I'm letting this go on a little bit too long on purpose or cutting it a bit short and just seeing like how that changes and also, you know, like playing more with the drums or like with a synth or piano, or like you sort of sit with different instruments in a different way. And so it's like kind of looking at that role is really important. And one of the things that helped me, I think, be a better bass player and understand bass more like that was when I got more into composition and I kind of stopped playing bass for a while. And then when I went back to bass, like, one, I played much more simply than I did before, which was all two-hand tapping. Like, YouTube wasn't a big thing, but I probably would have had my own channel. You know, I would have been like, hey, guys, you know, like, and all that. But, like, now it's, you know, like, then I came back and I was like, look at me, I'm playing whole notes, you know? So it's just kind of understanding like the point. And also, I mean, still today, like, I would say I mostly overplay anyway, and like most of my playing,
a lead bass player,
well yeah, fair. But like, but it is that, you know, like, that's all there, but like at the root and core of it for me is still that, you know, simple walking bass line that's like leading harmony or like playing with the other chord structures, you know, and making everything richer. And like, that's the space I like to be in, certainly when I get to just be a bassist a lot of times.
Yeah. I completely agree.
Absolutely. And also the first point that Jeffrey JJ makes in his question is, as a guitarist who has played bass a few times and found it really difficult, I think it's really important to not try everything you can to not make it difficult for yourself as well. And that's, you know, in the traditional role of the bass, that's one of the beauties of it, is it doesn't have to be difficult. You are just holding down a root, you know. It kind of comes back to the same point that we're sort of all mutually making, which is that, it doesn't have to be lots of notes. It doesn't have to be long notes. It doesn't have to be complex. It doesn't have to be fast. outside of the super golden rule of play for the song. You know, there is a lot that you can play with the bass in terms of keeping things simple that you potentially can't afford to do with instruments like the guitar.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that quite nicely rounds off a very thorough answer to that question. I'm pretty happy with our answer to that question. That wasn't bad.
Also, and of course, just before you wrap it up, I also want to say thank you for saying that it can be difficult to play bass, because you don't get that from a lot of guitar players. There's like,
yes,
only
thank
four
you.
Strings.
Jacko only needed four.
Yeah. There is footage of Jacko playing a five string, just FYI.
Well, there you go.
Well, there you go. And
on that bombshell.
Well, that is the end. Thank you, dear listener, for joining us on this 10-episode series of The Bass Guitar Nerds. We're going to be back in the middle of December for the Gear of the Year podcast episode, where we're going to decide the best bass guitar, best bass amplifier, and best bass effects pedal released in 2020. And then, you know, after that, we're going to be back in the new year with season 2 of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. So thank you very much for tuning in. We'll be back soon with more of this bass guitar nerdery. Farewell.